Change happens. How we respond to change can make or break us and our careers. Join us for an intimate insight into how senior business leaders face change, the good, the bad, and everything in between. Because whether we like it or not, change happens.
Hi, my name's Janelle McMaster, and welcome to the Change Happens podcast, a conversation with senior business leaders on leading through change and the lessons learned along the way. Today, I have the great privilege of speaking with someone who has a very different profile from the corporate and government leaders I've been speaking with over the last 6 months. I've asked one of Australia's most versatile entertainers, broadcaster, author, journalist, and stage performer, Wendy Harmer, to join me to share her reflections on leadership and what COVID-19 has meant for the arts and entertainment industry. Wendy is a veteran of countless international comedy festivals and hosted Today FM's top rating breakfast show for 11 years, winning 84 of the 88 rating surveys for that period. She's a strong advocate for women, making a mark in media industry, and she was FM radio's first true female superstar who truly opened the door for women in FM radio. As a stand-up comedian, Wendy has performed her one-woman shows across the world, including Melbourne, Edinburgh, London, Montreal, and Glasgow. She's had great success writing fiction and non-fiction titles, including Farewell My Ovaries, Love and Punishment, and her series of children's books, Pearly in the Park. That series was a bestseller in Australia and has been published in 10 countries around the world. On top of all that, Wendy also wrote for and co-produced the hit TV animation series of Pearly. I look forward to exploring how Wendy has managed all the change in the recent COVID months, but also how she creates change and how she reflects the changes in our country and culture through her work. Gosh, that was a mouthful. Wendy, how are you?
I'm well, thank you.
I need to lie down.
Thanks, Janelle. I'm even tired.
Yeah, I can understand it. Now tell me, Wendy, you know, we're all navigating COVID here. How has COVID affected your daily work life?
It's so interesting that you asked that question, because just this morning I'm on ABC Sydney Breakfast Radio at the moment, and I've been broadcasting from home since about March. Mm-hmm. You know, every day we catch up of pre and post program and during the program, of course. When you're on Zoom and you're catching up and then mid program and before the program, after the program, whatever. The one thing that you do miss is the process of brainstorming when you're all in a room together. Somehow, I think this is a little bit of a danger, that Zoom can sometimes become process-driven rather than ideas-driven. Mm. So you do, I think, lose a little bit in creativity. Why is that? Why should that be? I think what can happen is that there is someone who is perhaps not included, you know, the other people that can dominate, or those who are sort of process driven can take control of proceedings rather than those who are idea driven. It's an interesting one.
It is actually. Yeah, I do think that something happens when you're in the room. I'm just, you know, exploring this one as I, you know, speak out loud here. But when we're in the room, and I was in the room in the office yesterday for the first time in a very long time, and I did feel there was more idea generation, mostly because we were quite happy to interrupt and add on. And when you're on a Zoom call, I do feel you tend to be more respectful of your turn, now my turn, and therefore you don't have that kind of bumping up against ideas and sort of organically creating stuff.
That ping, ping, ping that can happen.
Well, I think being mindful about that and finding other ways to get that creativity is an important part of this. Now, you're talking to the community every day on the radio. Interested in whether, do you think we're more connected at this time? And I know that we're socially distanced, so in a physical sense we're not, but what's your sense of the current sentiment of society?
Well, it's interesting. I am a real person who's swimming against the tide on this one, I've got to say. And all right.
I'm sure that's not the first time you've said that, Wendy.
Well, there is almost an industry built up around the fact that we're more lonely than we ever were before. Mm-hmm. But from what I've done, from my reading, it looks like the statistics on loneliness are not that much different than they were in the 1940s. Mm. I don't believe that we are more lonely than we ever have been. I grew up in country, Victoria. I know what a loan means. It means when you're living on a property and there's one phone and your dad doesn't want you to call. It's get off that phone. It's long distance. And your brothers are listening in and the other farm is too far away. I really do think that we are more connected than ever. And it's interesting that the statistics about suicide apparently during COVID-19 haven't risen, even though people are saying that there is an epidemic of loneliness. I think that we're more connected than we ever have been. I think we could look at the quality of the way that we connect, perhaps, but I don't think it's true to say that we're more lonely. Yes, we more of us are living alone than we ever have been, but I'm not sure that really equates then very directly to loneliness.
It's a really interesting one to unpack. I had the privilege of interviewing John Brogdon, who is the chair of Lifeline, and he was sharing a lot of statistics about the spike in calls for help, mental health, mental resilience, suicide risk. And when we talked about the metrics and he talked about these staggering stats, I did say it was a bittersweet metric, or I don't know whether it's a good or bad thing, because the reality is now more people do feel that they can reach out. We've got a language to articulate loneliness versus being alone. We've got support mechanisms in place. We have the Are You Okay Day. So there is a spike because it's now okay to be able to talk. So we have surfaced some stuff that was always there before. Really hard to really work out what's going on there, but I do think there's a positive sign in more people reaching out and talking about it than before.
I mean, I think, obviously on social media we have got the phenomenon of a generation clocking in and comparing themselves with others. And I mean, it's not just a teenage thing, but if you're on social media, all your friends are having a better life than you are.
Absolutely.
And really,
FOMO all over the place.
Doesn't matter how successful you are, that's still happening. But I think that you're right. I think that we now have a lot of tools at our disposal to be able to connect if we want to. We also, this is obviously, we have a lot of ways to disconnect if we don't want to, because sometimes, in the old days at least, and I'm sure it happens in many communities, the pressure of family and expectations is huge. And that's why a lot of us, generations of Australians past, took off overseas, left our families behind, moved interstate. And so on some levels you could say we have a very sort of disconnected society, and you could say that's a bad thing. But on the other hand, you could say we are a nation of people who are able to, follow their own heart and their own dreams without overwhelming burden of familial expectation. I mean, on balance, I think, it's a good thing.
So many of the leaders that I've been speaking with over the past 6 months are finding themselves in a situation for the first time that you've actually commanded for 3 decades, and that's connecting with and engaging with people virtually. That has been exactly what you've been doing for a long, long time. And I've heard you talk about your years in radio and how much you loved connecting with your listeners. You talked about moments of utter vulnerabilities when listeners ring in and tell you about some incredibly personal moments. And we're seeing in business leaders now getting exposure to staff members in areas of vulnerability that they wouldn't have seen to this extent before. We are talking about mental health. We're talking about job loss, loss of identity, anxiety and the ambiguity. We're seeing glimpses into people's home lives and stacks of washing in the background. What's your advice to people where this is so much of a foreign concept to have to engage in this way?
That is such a big question. I think firstly I've got to say is that if you perceive that someone is in genuine distress, you've got to take that very seriously and you've got to, engage professional help. I just want to say that at the outset. I just think, I think the message over and over that I've learned from radio, Janelle, because I can't see people and they can't see me, and so I've just learned the lesson of listen, 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 listen. Listen really deeply and just try to really tune in. I mean, it may be something that a person says that you feel kind of repelled by, rather than dismiss it, you can say, why do you think that? Where did that come from? Where was that? Where did you learn that lesson? Who taught you that? And you can get back to some very, very interesting answers rather than just shut people down.
It's great. I want to turn to, you know, topics around transparency and vulnerability. I heard you make the statement once, the biggest thing that I had to do on radio is to know who I was going to be on radio. And then you went on to explain that you needed to decide what you would and wouldn't share, what kind of persona you'd have. You know, reveal it all and you'll bore or you'll overwhelm the listeners. Don't reveal enough and you'll be robotic and unrelatable. And you also said that no matter what's happening in your life, you have to set the tone on air. And I kind of want to put that in a bit of context of our worlds here. We find ourselves in a world where expectation is much higher to reveal more of ourselves at work, to show vulnerability, be more human, but we're still going to be strong and hold ourselves to extremely high standards. Maybe it's a different world, but I'm interested in how you've been able to strike the right balance for you and what counsel you might have for others trying to find the right balance of what and how much they bring of themselves into the workplace.
Well, you know, that's a very big question with a lot of threads
to it. I like big questions, Wendy.
Maybe I can just give you a little bit of an answer here. My job, and I've always thought this, on radio, is to not bring my personal travails into the workplace. And I know that sounds ridiculous. You know, you're allowed to be vulnerable. Of course you're allowed to be vulnerable, but you're not allowed to bring in what's happened at home and infect the workplace or more importantly in my world, bring that into the radio. So I spent many, many years having a little moment where I would, before I went on air, and I still do it to this day on ABC in the mornings, I sort of do a little bit of a mental check of where I am and I think, well, what am I bringing to people here? Am I bringing my kind of best, upbeat, optimistic self? And if I'm not, I just go and stand in the corner. I mean, I physically remove myself. I did it for years.
You put yourself in a corner.
I stand myself in the corner and I just think, you know, what are we on about here, Wendy? What's my job? You know, what am I doing? It doesn't mean to say that I might not burst into tears over something or be cross, you know, but just to really have an internal check.
Now, given the strength of your personal profile, you're obviously a recognised personality, you're a comedian, author. It's really easy to think of you as a solo operator, but you've had many decades in radio and you would have worked in many, many teams over the course of your radio career. So, and you touched upon this in the beginning, you know, that sort of creativity. You know, there would be the need for a lot of creativity, brainstorming, different ideas that have to be pitched, some get, you know, up, some don't. I would imagine that there'd be times that go from peak tension through to peak engagement. How do you work with teams to get that right balance of creative tension versus tipping into that more destructive or counterproductive level of conflict?
Oh, well, you know, I'm an expert in this. I've managed to survive, but whether I'd be an expert. Well, one of the greatest things I love in a group, someone who's maybe a junior comes up with this idea and says, well, I'd like to do a series on air of la, 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 la. And you can just see everyone around the room going, well, obviously this person's not up to this. They're never going to be able to pull it off. What are we even thinking about this? And I love saying, fantastic, do it. And then even if it's not up to snuff, put it on air. And then you ask the person, well, what did you think of that? And they'll say, well, I could see it could be improved by this, 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 this. And I'm always really energised by that. When I go back to my early comedy career, that's exactly how it was for me when I was doing, you know, the big gig all those years ago, 30 years ago. I had a director, Ted Robinson, who would say, right, we're going to give you a monologue or whatever it might be, and you know, we need 7 minutes. And I would go, oh, my God, I don't think I can do that. And but I would be an enthusiast and I would rise to the occasion. And then I come out afterwards and say, and this has been on national television, mind you, and I would ask him afterwards, what did you think? What did you think? And he'd say, well, what did you think?
Yeah.
And, of course, anyone who's worth their salt is going to say, well, I could have done that better, because that person is going to be their best critic.
Yes.
and they are going to improve beyond all sight. So I'm a great believer in giving really hard jobs to people, you know, who put their hands up and might not, you might have a little bit of a doubt if they could do it. But I tell you what, they are going, they're the ones that are going to be the best people.
Mm.
The ones that put their hands up for a job that they're probably not quite up to the mark for doing, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, I do.
One of the things that's brilliant about radio that I love, and it's always attracted me to radio, is that we plan and plan and plan and plan radio. You know, we gather in meetings before, during, yep, after the show. It goes, it's incessant. But the thing that actually gives me the most excitement is we get on air and all of a sudden all our plans that we get, they're beautiful. You know, they're all there. They're up on the board. They're lovely. They're in type. They're gorgeous. And then someone just throws an incendiary bomb in it, be a listener or whatever, or a news item, and then the whole thing's just chucked in the bin. I love nothing more than chucking a plan in the bin.
What is it that you love so much about that?
Well, what it is, it means that you're working in the moment. It means that it's like stand-up too, that you're feeding off, you know, good stand-up, you're feeding off what happens in the moment. You might have a set routine, but a heckler might throw something in, or, you know, a light might fall down out of the ceiling or whatever it might be, and then you're just forced off into some kind of flight of fancy. And that's really when you're in a really incredibly creative zone. Mm. And the audience also recognises that this is something that they're never going to hear again. This is something really special and bespoke and unique, and they're lucky to be a part of it, and they go along with it. And it's really one of those things that I think about radio that's so lovely, is often it's, well, you had to be there. You had to be there. And one of the things about being in radio that you have to face up to is it's completely ephemeral. It's gone. Mm. It's absolutely gone. And mercifully, put in the rubbish bin, you know, along with your, you know, along with your embarrassment gland and along with your dignity and everything else. It's all put in the rubbish bin at the end of the day, and then you start afresh, which is a kind of a lovely thing. And you can't stand on your dignity. You asked me a little earlier about figuring out who you are on radio. You can figure it out to a certain extent, but I tell you what, over time, you can't fake it. People are going to figure out exactly who you are.
Now, Wendy, this is a podcast that's all about people's experiences with change. Change happens.
Mm-hmm.
There's the change that people proactively seek out, as well as the change that's, you know, foisted upon them. You've had plenty of experiences with both. You've had changes with your physical appearance. You've had multiple career changes, journalism, broadcasting, comedy, writing. You've had kids later in life. So I know this is a broad question, but tell me your views about change and, you know, what you think about change, how you manage it, and whether or not you even, you know, seek it out.
Chanel?
Yeah?
Would you like to break that question?
I told you it was a broad question. But is it something that you're hungry for?
Can I give you a radio series of about 2,000 parts at this point? Oh, my gosh. So a lot of questions. Oh, my gosh. All I can say is I've probably had plan A, B, C, D and E my whole life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, plan A, you know, international superstar. Plan
Tick.
B, right down to, I mean, and in media as well, you know, right down to, I mean, it was so funny because I was talking about this on the air the other day and we were talking about exactly this thing about, you know, change and what's on your sort of bucket list or whatever of things that you might do. Everything goes pear-shaped. And mine was open a range of salsas, you know, Wendy Harmer's salsa range, because I'm quite a dab hand of, you know, growing chilies.
Okay.
And so I've kind of had that, you know, a bit like Paul Newman. I've kind of had that
sauces
in the
coming
bottom
out.
Drawer. That is sort of, you know, my cascading list of things that I can do. What can I say? There's always another opportunity.
Well, it seems like you really do seek out ways to try different things, seek different things, learn different things about yourself.
Yeah, well, I've, you know, because of my upbringing and, you know, having a cleft palate when I was young, and my dad was a very hard taskmaster in wanting me to be able to speak very well. I hosted the first episode of the big gig on national television, I rang my dad and he said, he's a headmaster, and he said, I thought the diction was quite good.
The diction?
Crikey.
That is a word that is not used much these days.
Well, exactly.
Diction.
And then my mother noted that I had a short skirt on. She said, what do you think your knees are saying, Wendy? I mean, really. Anyway.
Well, let's just stay there for a second, Wendy. You're not with your knees or with the short skirt, but I mean on the topic of... What I'd say is there are a lot of heavily used, if not overused, words at this time, certainly not diction, but words like unprecedented, new normal, or pivot. And some seem to have really lost their power and their impact by virtue of their overuse, like resilience. But words like resilience are very real words and is a very real attribute that's being called upon. We're all being asked to sort of develop in this time. I want to talk about your lessons in resilience because, as you said, you were born with a severe case of bilateral cleft lip and palate, and that wasn't properly corrected until age 15, which I reckon has to be one of the most sensitive times in your developing years when, you know, the acute sensitivity to looks, to difference, to acceptance is at its all-time high. You were brought up, as you say, you know, your father was a headmaster. You've described that as a tough love regime. There were quite brutal times through that. How do you forge resilience through that?
You know, it's such a funny thing, Janelle. These days, I'm, you know, every now and then I get a text saying, well, it's all right for you to be resilient because you had a really bad time.
Oh, wow, that's an interesting perspective on it.
Hello? Well, gosh, you know, Janelle, I'm not really sure where it comes from either, and I have interviewed a lot of people over the years who find that resilience, and I'm not really sure where it comes from either. I think that can you learn resilience? I wonder whether you can. I'm not really sure. There is a good deal of psychological research which says if you can't do something, you can do something by pretending you can do it. Yep. Do you know this?
Yes.
If you're not a confident person, you know, fake being a confident person.
Make it till you make it.
Really interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, there's been a really interesting article written, I think it's Oliver Berkman, who talks about imposter syndrome and sort of says you have to recognise, the first step to imposter syndrome is recognising that you are an imposter. The reality is there's a first for everybody, right? So everyone is actually trying to figure it out. Some are just more honest about it than others.
I'm with you. This whole imposter syndrome, I really loathe. As if it's special, as if it's only some people feel it. I think that we all do. I mean, I think it's completely natural to feel like you're an imposter. And, in fact, I think it's a good motivator. Mm. It's a great motivator to say, well, I feel like I'm an imposter, but I'm going to learn my craft here and I'm going to put in the solid work, and then I won't feel like an imposter anymore. But it's actually a really motivating feeling, I think.
I think so. I think if you use it as an impetus, I mean, the first time you wrote a book, you were an imposter in the author space.
Course.
You'd never done it before, but you lean into
it. Well, you're an imposter as a teenager. You've never been a teenager
it's
before.
True.
Like, duh. Resilience can be something that you think is some muse, is something that is out there in the ether, some mystical sort of quality. But resilience can also be, okay, I'm going to be really methodical about this. I'm going to say, okay, I got knocked back on this. This means I can do this. I mean, in some ways, resilience can be a flowchart. It can be a personal flowchart for you. You say, this person doesn't like me, okay, I'll go there. This project won't work, or okay, I'll go there. Okay, if I've got no there, then I've got a yes here. But I think that you can use intelligence to sort of plan your way out of it. It isn't a completely terrible thing when you are absolutely, you know, overlooked and bullied and, you know, and victimised and all those terrible things. But for a lot of the people who you would say were resilient, I will bet you they have sat down and they've looked at it on paper and thought, okay, there is another way around this. Mm-hmm. There is another way that I can go. I can go, under or around or over this obstacle, and then I can find another way. I can find, people who can help me. I can find, aides and colleagues and services or whatever that might be. And then I'm going, that will help me go into, be here. So I think, as for the spirit, though, that makes you go back to the drawing board, I don't know where that comes from. I really don't. But I think most of us probably have it. Because I'm not like Donald Trump. I don't think it's in the DNA at all.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I would never say it's in the DNA. There is something else going on there which is interesting, and I actually think it's Dad in some ways teaching me about systems.
Yeah.
And how to learn. And if you start to know about systems and how to learn, then you learn how to plan, and then you learn how to find information, and then you learn how to get around obstacles. And so resilience, as I say, isn't some weird mystical thing that's handed to you like a Sermon on the Mount.
Well, I was just going to say as well on that how to learn bit, I think that's really important because if you have an experience and then you try something and it didn't work, and if you pause to reflect on that it didn't work, and then you might try something else, that mindful learning is actually what then you feed into getting up again and having another go. Mm. Wendy, you talked about bullying and being victimised, and I think this is probably an extension of this resilience conversation, but I read an opinion piece that you wrote about your experience of the first time you were getting on the school bus after you'd had your life-changing surgery. It was an incredibly powerful description of that school bus experience. You talk about the dynamics of the bus, the dominance hierarchies, you talk about the dominant males had the back seat, the alpha females were just in front of them, the nondescript in the middle, the misfits and newbies at the front. And you wrote, being nondescript was our survival mechanism, and anyone who was different was brutally picked on. So the name of the game was safety in numbers and to blend in as much as possible. And honestly, when I read that, it brought back strong memories for me. I was teased as a kid as the only dark-skinned girl in my school. I worked overtime to make sure I never took curries into school. I Vegemite sandwiches and blue eyeliner like all the blue-eyed girls would wear. And I worked myself really hard to be as white, and I put that in inverted commas, as possible at the time. And yet you've made a career of standing out on your own. You've put yourself on the biggest stages. And when I think about this resilience thing, do you remember how and when you made a decision to actually leverage those differences as your source of strength rather than hide it away and blend in?
Can I just preface this answer by saying, Janelle, of course you just hid away and blended in. I mean, you've taken the same lessons as me, haven't you?
I have. It's taken me a very, very long time to realise that that actually was my superpower, those differences. But I'm interested in moment happened for you.
I'm interested in you now.
Oh, here we go. This is always the risk with speaking to a radio announcer.
How did you get to the point where you realised it was your superpower?
You know, for the longest time in business, and I'm not sure how we got to this point, but anyway, with you turning the tables on me, but I remember being in business and being told, you'll be a partner in this firm one day, and I kept saying, but I don't look like everybody else. I'm not, male. I want to be a mum. I want to, I'm ethnic. I started my career in the army, for goodness sake, and not in consulting at all. And then I sort of realised that actually there's a whole sea of people that look, with no disrespect to any of those people, but they looked the same, and actually my voice is different. And there were a whole lot of people that I worked with who kept saying to me, oh, you're like us, or, oh, funny, there were more people like you around. And my boss said to me, well, if you can't see it, just be it. Like, be that person that you wanted to see yourself. And I did do that, and I had to trust in the fact that the organisation would let me be, I'd stay true to me, and that it would let me shine as that, and full credit to the organisation, it absolutely did. But that took quite some time.
So what's your background, Janelle?
I'm Fijian Indian.
Okay. And so you were in the army?
Yeah, I started my career in prisons. I was a forensic psychologist by background.
Wow.
Yep, studied, loved Silence of the Lambs, was fascinated about it, wanted to be Clarice Starling, who had this ability to connect with people on a level that, could see something in everybody. So that was the beginning of my, and then I joined the army as a military psych. So I did about 7 years there, and then I changed into corporate psychology.
So what your, what you're pursuing now, and I sense that you pursued earlier on in life, you said you're looking for clarity. How do you pursue something like clarity? I mean, is it actually achievable, do you think?
Somebody once said something to me, which was I asked the question of how do I get clear if you don't know, like if you don't know things like purpose, if you don't know what you want to be doing next. And someone said something which didn't seem profound at the time but actually has taken all more prominence for me. He said, activity breeds clarity. Get out there, speak to people. You'll get a sense of what resonates with you. You'll get a sense of what you don't like and you'll get a sense of what things you do like. And I think clarity has just come from doing rather than imagining or planning. I've just kind of gotten in there and gone, that worked, that didn't, that resonated, that didn't. I got feedback from people that that mattered to them and that made me feel good. And I felt that that was a space that was sitting comfortably for me or comfortably uncomfortable, and I felt like I was growing through that. So I think that's been a part of that.
Well, Janelle, you know, to get back to your question, there's a bit of a journey there, I guess, about being the nondescript kid in the middle to being the person standing up on stage going blah, 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 blah. How did all that happen? That's probably a pretty good question. I got to the point, I suppose, in my late 20s where people stared at me so much, you know, and said things about me behind my back so much because of the way that I looked. And I thought, okay, if you're going to stare at me, I'm going to give you something to stare at. So I thought, all right, I'm going to put myself up on stage in the last laugh and I'm going to do stand-up comedy. Wow. And if you want to make a comment, go right ahead because this is me and you can look at me and you can tell me what you think of me. Of course, it completely backfired. I ended up telling most people what it was I thought about them than anyone what they thought about me. But it was kind of
really put it on the table.
It was just a little bit of a line in the sand where I said, "You want to talk about me? I'll give you something about." And it's kind of that's where it went from there, really. I know that's a weird thing to say.
Where does that confidence come from? Where does that bravado, that confidence come from?
Oh, rank stupidity, probably. I can tell you about the night that it happened.
Yeah, do it.
How I went from being a political journalist and they said, oh, Wendy, you're good, you're off on your way to Canberra to be in the press gallery. And I thought, actually, I think that might not, you know, I'm really sad I missed out on that in some ways. But
that's in the plan F, plan G.
Plan F, that was, yeah, exactly. So I was sent one night to cover, as a young journo, to cover a night of cabaret at Monash University. It was called the New Cabaret. It was the thing, darling.
Okay.
And there was Paul Grabowski and Steve Vizard, who was singing Frank Sinatra. Gina Riley was in the show, you know, Richard Stubbs, a whole lot of the people. And I just sat there and I thought, holy hell, this is amazing. This is the best thing I've ever seen. Anyway, so I went back to work and I duly wrote my little review of the show. And about a month later, I just handed in my resignation. I said, I'm going to be a stand-up comedian. And I went, what? Are you insane? So I went and worked on a local community newspaper, so I had the time to be able to work on my stand-up routines and, you know, get up the nerve, get up the guts to be a stand-up comedian. I listened to lots of records of people who did stand-up comedy, you know, American women really, because there weren't that many, there weren't any Australian women stand-ups that I could listen to. So I listened to Joan Rivers and Whoopi Goldberg. Then I sort of booked myself into an open mic night at La Joke and Last Laugh. And everybody said, you know, and I knew quite a few, but by this time I was a bit of a groupie. You know, I was hanging around watching all the comedy and I booked myself in. And all the blokes said, oh, my God, it is so terrible. It is so traumatic. You'll probably throw up, but don't worry about that. You'll be fine. So I walk out on stage and I stand there with the microphone and the light comes on and I go, are you kidding? I get paid. I'm in the spotlight.
Oh, you loved it
I've
straight
got
away.
A microphone and there's no one to interrupt me. Okay, you know, are you kidding? This is the best thing in my entire life. And so it was just for me, it was a bit of an epiphany, really. And here I am at the age of 65 in a couple of weeks, wow, still standing there going, are you kidding? You mean I get paid? I have a microphone. Doesn't get any better than this. So just a professional big mouth in the end.
Well, you know what? Well done to you, because we always say that if you can find something that you love, that you are good at and that people are willing to pay for, then you've struck gold. So you've hit the trifecta.
Cha-ching, jackpot.
Nice.
You know, and, you know, I've got to say, you know, if I wasn't being paid for it, you'd probably find me in Hyde Park standing on a soapbox going, and another thing.
All those people that have paid you a fortune, like, damn it, if only I'd known that, I could have got it for free. how do you actually plan for what's next, though? I know you've got all these ideas and the salsa's, you know, right up there with them, but how do you plan for what's next?
Well, I do have plans. I've got my little five-year plan ready.
Okay.
Maybe it's about when I wrote my kids' books, I included a lot of lists. I know that little girls love lists.
Yes.
Yeah, and I think maybe as a big girl, I don't mind a list as well. Just say I could do this and I could do this and I could do this. I like to psychologically always, this is my big thing, prepare myself psychologically for the next bit, so that I can land in a good place. That sometimes takes a bit of work.
Well, what does psychologically preparing yourself look like?
That is, I'll say being a Libran, and then now I'll listen to everyone else. What does psychologically preparing myself look like? That's talking to friends, talking to family, boring them, absolutely.
Testing
shitless.
It out, really. Yeah, testing
reading
out the idea.
A lot. Trying on sort of different imaginary costumes, and maybe, counselling along the way too, okay. So I can sort my thoughts. But, I think I like to be the mistress of my own destiny. Mm. As a child, I come from a broken family and a very difficult broken family. I don't like surprises. I'm imagining you don't either, Janelle.
No, not my favourite. My husband will laugh when he hears me say this. What's your hope for society? We're all navigating this global pandemic. What would you hope for as a society that we come out, how we come out of this? Is there some changes that you would hope that we would take forward with us forever?
Look, I mean, not going to be any changes. We're just going to come out as a sort of venal, backstabbing, you know, terrible people we have.
I was going to finish on this note, but now I have to think of another question.
Climbed out of the primordial swamp. But optimism. I think the only game in town is optimism. Yeah. I'm a big fan of optimism. I don't really know what else there is to be said. The one thing, you know, it's interesting when I met my husband, who's a very a dyed-in-the-wool activist, greenie, whatever, he drives me up the wall. I can't tell you.
It's too good. As
the reason that I married him, he said, in the past we didn't kind of know how bad things were. Now we do. Now we can take action. I thought, oh, that's pretty good. I think I'll marry you. You know, I'm an optimist. You know, I've got my rosy coloured glasses on because the one thing that radio has brought me over the years is you're in touch with so many good people who care so much and who love their families. And I just believe in the good. I can't think any other way. The other way is too depressing.
I'm with you. And look, I've spoken to a lot of leaders in this time, and optimism is the common characteristic and trait of all of them.
The last three fast questions on change to finish the podcast.
I want to finish up, Wendy. We always finish with a three fast questions. It's more on the lighthearted side, not that there hasn't been lighthearted moments throughout this, but what's a misconception that most people have about you?
They don't have any. I've been talking about myself for 30 years. What are you even talking about? They don't have any. None.
Fair everything. Enough. I think that's fair enough. All right, what about one guilty pleasure? Maybe you don't feel guilty about any of your pleasures, but tell me.
I'd watch trash television like you wouldn't believe.
Okay, we are definitely have to
check. My one guilty pleasure is shows about wedding dresses. You know, say yes to the dress. Yes. Just any show that's about a wedding, I'm there. It's pathetic.
Interesting. Okay, great. And what's one thing that you're hopeless at?
Well, I'm a pretty fantastic free-form dancer, especially if I've had a couple of drinks. But I want to take you back to the last laugh in 1980-something, and I had to learn a dance routine, and there was someone from Tony Bartuccio Dancers who came to, you know, teach us this routine. I think Magda Szubanski was on stage as well. And he was reduced at the end of an hour to being on his knees and having my right foot and my left foot in his hands and crying.
Okay, so I've got some crazy visual that I'm sure it's not right. The contortions just cannot be right.
I cannot learn a dance routine. It is of a great sadness. But I don't know my left from my right.
Okay, I've got Elaine Bennis from Seinfeld visual happening now.
Yeah, my husband calls me Compass. I still mix up my left from my right. I'm 64, for Christ's sake.
Okay. Well, Wendy, I would love to keep talking to you, and I've loved the conversation today. But a few things for me that I've taken away from our conversation. I love the message around tuning in, you know, listening for the nuance, and investing time to unlock personal stories. I've loved the message around the power of being in the moment, letting it go and really exploring what's in that moment. And the conversation around resilience and finding an alternative way and learning how to learn as two aspects that are key to building resilience. So many, many other things in there, but it's been a wonderful conversation. I can't thank you enough for your time.
Well, thank you, Janelle. And I think our next podcast is, I'm interviewing you, is that right?
Nope, we're done. We're done. Thanks, Wendy.
Thank you so much.
The Change Happens podcast from EY, a conversation on leading through change. Discover more where you get your podcasts.